Yo friends, Aaron here. I just wanted to share that this episode is going to be part one of a two-part series on improving execution and performance of specific exercises. On this first episode, we are going to focus on the lower body, and then next week we're going to come back and hit the rest with upper body. So I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast, where we provide you sustainable training principles for strength and building muscle, effective nutrition practices for improving and maintaining a lean physique, and practical lifestyle habits for becoming a champion of your own health, both inside and out. Hosted by Aaron Straker and Brian Borstein. Welcome to episode 3 of the Eat, Train, Prosper podcast. Today, Brian and I are talking about some tips and tricks that we've kind of discovered over our lifting careers that improve kind of exercise execution and performance of specific exercises within the context of what you were performing them for. So an example would be for hypertrophy versus like power or output for strength. So Brian, how has the last couple days been going for you since the new year hit?
Everything's good, man. Training's going well. I'm reaching a point where I'm training just as hard with just as many sets and I'm just not really getting sore anymore. So I think that that's an interesting development and probably speaks to a few different things, potentially the need for a deload as well. So, you know, more updates to come on that. I think my next, cycle here after deload is going to be a specialization phase of sorts, with priority on hamstrings and maybe some quads. I'm not sure. I got to talk to my coach, but, everything's going well. I got my hack press leg machine fixed. It was user error. I thought it was the fault of the machine. And after many back and forth emails, I took the machine apart, put it back together, realized that I inserted a attachment piece and tightened it when they specifically said, do not tighten until the end. Never had an issue with that before, but now I understand why you are not supposed to tighten things until the end.
Yeah, it's always kind of funny when you figure that out. And yep. At the end of the day, it's
you. How about you?
So for me, last 7 days have been pretty good. You know, scheduling into the new year, I'm wrapping up a launch, so that's always really busy time. Jenny and I got away for a couple days to celebrate some accomplishments in 2020, so that was pretty cool just to like tap out for like 2 days and walk around, eat some seafood, which was really, really cool. But I'm excited now just to get back into my routine. I really, really thrive on routine, so I really like it. Training's going really, really well. I'm now 2 weeks into I'm on a leg specialization, so training legs 3 times per week. And I was really pleasantly surprised around that third day. Going into the third day last week, I had a little bit of soreness still in like my VMO. But after the training session, just getting like so much blood in there, I felt better after than when I went in. So that's always kind of an interesting perspective how that can happen. Mm-hmm. And then I just crushed like a shit ton of rice the rest of the day as we were walking around and outside a lot and sweating a lot. So that really helped. And then I have tomorrow will be that third day again. I feel my legs already feel pretty good. So I'm excited about that. Training's going well.
Sweet. And continue.
Yeah, training's going well, and I'm just, you know, ready for the new year, ready to get back to work and keep hammering.
Nice. And then one of the things that you got to do during your little getaway trip was it Isla Mujeres?
Isla Mujeres, yeah.
Isla Mujeres. You got to use that super dope leverage squat machine that you love that lets you hammer your quads so well. So why is that machine so good for you?
Oh, so it's like perfect for this conversation we're going to have on the podcast.
Yep.
It just fits my like leverages or my levers, I should say, which is interesting because it's called the lever squat, like perfectly. So the amount of the angle that the foot plate is in allows me to get in like a full, you know, ankle dorsiflexion position without it being like too much, like some of the old school hack squats where it will like limit your range of motion. The way that the machine kind of goes over your like traps onto your back allows you to really like lean back into it, which removes that like balancing portion, right? You can just, and you can go, you kind of, it's a, kind of like a swing angle, you know? So you get super, super deep. I can keep my entire foot flat on the pad perfectly fine without any weird positioning. And it's just like a really good resistance pattern through the entire curve. So it's really, you know, challenging in the bottom and it's still really challenging like 70, 80% of the concentric portion of the movement. So it's great on my joints. Everything about it I love. So I was super, super pumped to find it in this little like hole in the wall gym on an island. And we actually were going to head down to Tulum in like the last weekend of the month. We have a couple really big work weekends we can't do anything for. And I already found one there too. And it's like same thing, another little hole in the wall gym. And I guess it's like one of the things that they just put in the gyms here when people create gyms, which is very cool.
Very cool. Do you feel like it's similar to a pendulum squat machine?
It is very, very similar. It's a little bit more, the pendulum squat kind of pushes you more back. So that like, as opposed to like up. So the curve is a little bit different. The pendulum squat requires a more equipment space. You know, it's a little bit longer. This one is a little bit more compact, but it's a very, very similar stimulus, but not quite 100% as like the pendulum.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, that's awesome. I obviously started looking at leverage squat machines after you sent me that. Yeah. And I found a few for under $1,000. So maybe I'll try and like finagle my gym and create another spot for a new machine.
Yeah, I remember saying, I was like, man, this one's like a, because when we were talking about the pendulum squat, it's like a few thousand dollars, you know, and this one, I was like, it's almost the same thing. It's not that big. It's like, seems kind of reasonable to have in a home gym. And I wanted to see what the price was. And I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, it's arguably a pretty decent deal.
The size is really a huge factor too. Like the hack press machine I have is compact and a pendulum squat is huge, but this thing sits more vertically. So I think that, you know, there is a possibility that it could fit at some point.
Yeah. What's really cool is that's going to kind of lead us right into our first kind of body part that we were talking about with this episode today. So Brian, tell us a little bit more about like quadriceps and then any kind of specific movement patterns you really like for it or movements that you like to target your quads. I think what's important to provide with the context of this podcast is we are talking primarily about hypertrophy, unless we will kind of say for a strength pattern or like a power output pattern. But in terms of the majority of this conversation will be in regards to hypertrophy.
For sure. Yeah. And then with the context of hypertrophy, I think Dr. Isertel's stimulus to fatigue ratio is an important thing to keep in mind because that is something that I think is intuitive for most people that focus on physique in that you kind of just know that you're not supposed to choose movements that destroy your body. And you know that you're supposed to pay a little bit more attention to the way that your muscles are feeling through the movement. So I think even intuitively, if you don't have a stimulus fatigue ratio specifically, you make decisions in your programming, or you should be making decisions in your programming, partially based off of movements that are providing a stimulus to the target muscle and not to the muscles that you're not targeting, kind of just wasting energy at that point or recovery resources. So kind of with that in mind, any squat pattern movement is going to involve both knee extension and hip extension. So think about when you sit down into a squat, your knees bend, and then you're also folding over slightly at the torso, and your hips going to bend as well. Even if you maintain a perfectly erect torso position, it still changes your hip angle. So that's important to keep in mind here, that when you squat, you cannot avoid the combination of both hip extension and knee extension. The degree by which a movement prioritizes the quads is going to be how much the movement biases knee extension versus hip extension. So if you can picture in your mind what a low bar squat would look like in general format, when practiced, you know, by powerlifters, you see them kind of fold in half at the hip and really create as minimal knee extension as necessary to get them to parallel, which is the requirement for them to then turn around and come back up and call it a good rep. In that type of squat, they're purposefully trying to take the quad out of the movement because the quad is significantly weaker than the force that your glutes and your erectors can put into the movement. So in turn, a bodybuilder or a physique athlete would want to do the exact opposite of that. What they would want to do is take this movement and bias it for the quad, because this then requires you to use less weight, which in turn means that you can get more stimulus to the quad with less debt caused into recovery. So as kind of like a basic background context, that's what we're looking at when we're talking about quad hypertrophy specifically. The ways that we can kind of go to increase knee flexion and decrease hip extension is, number one, elevating the heels. So this in itself is not magic. You can still mess a squat up and lean too far forward at the torso. What the heel elevation does is it increases the ability of your ankles to flex forward to create ankle dorsiflexion. This then allows the quad to stretch. However, I've seen this butchered so many times, right? So there's something that happens when you descend down into a squat if the priority is quads. And it's not just a matter of taking the rep from top position to the bottom of the squat and then coming back up again. You actively want to try and feel your quad stretching as you descend. This requires you to do it in a very controlled manner. You're not just dropping your butt down. You're actively trying to send the knees forward so that as the knees drive forward over the toes, you feel this immense stretch occur in your quad. And when you get to the bottom of the movement, you're not just sitting there with no tension just to be like, okay, I hit the bottom of the movement. Let's turn around and come back up. You're actively feeling that stretch engage so deep in the bottom of that squat that when you change direction and turn back around, the quad is just like ripping in pain. And this takes practice over many years to be able to get this feeling of building this tension in your quad as you descend, to feel it increasing, that stretching deeper and deeper. So kind of to kick this back to you real quick, and then I have more to say on the quad topic, but talk a little bit about kind of your experience with this positioning and the things that have helped you.
Yeah. So for me, it's been basically goal driven, right? So I kind of had gotten to this point through just, you know, lifting and, you know, my career, I guess, in the weight room, where I'd become like very, very top heavy. So the amount of muscle that I had on my upper body, like, was orders of magnitude more than my lower body. And I had always, you know, at some point in my lifting career when I was younger, I'd bought into that kind of ego thing. It's like, all you need is heavy squats, like squat heavy often, and that's what you need. So I did that a lot. But I think it's really interesting, because I'm sure you've kind of felt that same way. We have similar levers and you know, body sizes. Like, I'm not built to squat very well. Very, very long femur. And even though I have a good ankle dorsiflexion, my back is so much stronger than my quads, it would always take over. So when I'd hit the bottom of that squat, the first thing that would happen is my hips would shift back, put me in a more mechanically advantageous position for me to move like a free weight. So even though I did all this, like, my back would get stronger, you know what I mean? But my legs would never really grow. And then whenever we do like higher reps, my back would get smoked and my glutes would be on fire, but I'd never have that, like, that feeling of like a stimulus in my quads. Like, my legs would never get that pump because I just wasn't putting myself in a good position for that to occur. So as I kind of like moved in and really got serious about my, you know, quad goals, I kind of left that ego of, okay, all I need to do is squat heavy, because I did that for years and I never really produced any kind of fruits of the labor from it, and moved into more of like a bodybuilding style. So I would start, you know, using like the leg press or the Smith machine squat, so I could put myself in a position where my back would be kind of rigid, so I couldn't, you know, overpower the movement with my back, because the machine or whatever will hold you in that position. And that's when things really started to change. And I quickly found out like how, you know, untrained, I guess, to a certain degree, my quads were, because they would just like tap out really, really fast, or that buildup of that burning feeling would really kind of hit quickly. And it was just, but at the same time, they were finally starting to grow. So I think what was really, really important was finding positions that allowed me to like get to that full range of motion in a position where my knees felt really safe and comfortable. And I wasn't like letting the machine, you know, put me in a weird spot where I was putting like a twisting kind of force on my knee or anything like that. And just moving through a full range of motion, keeping my foot completely flat, whether that's on the ground, the plate on the leg press or the hack squat or something like that. And then things really, really started to change by, you know, using equipment that would kind of force me to not let my back overpower the movement and let my legs and quads do the work. And it's been, it sucks. You know, they're hard. Those days are really, really hard, you know, pushing quads for heavier or higher reps, but the stimulus is there. I'm getting like that really, really good quad pump and hamstring pump in the target muscles. And I'm finally, you know, starting to produce returns on that process.
Cool. Very cool. I think the biggest kind of response I get from people, at least people, you know, that aren't experienced with this type of squat, tends to be that, oh, well, if your knees are going that far forward, isn't this going to be really bad on your knees? And I think that the first thing to say is that if you have knee problems, you probably want to get those fixed before you put your knees in this position. But after that, I think that once you figure out how to load the muscle through that position and not the joint, that it really is, it's no worse for you than squatting any other way. And in fact, I would say that the fact that you learn how to load the muscle is going to benefit your knees in the long term, because you've finally figured out how to take that stress off the joints and put it into the muscles. And being able to feel a muscle stretch and lengthen as you lower is really the first step. So people always, you know, they rush the eccentric always, whether it's squats or bench press or any movement, people rush the eccentric and then they just try to get the weight back up. But if you just drop the weight and you don't actually build tension in the muscle as you're lowering the weight down, then it's putting a lot of that tension onto the joint and causing stress there, versus loading the muscle where the muscle can then change direction, use that stretch and come back up with tons and tons of tension. So, one little caveat there, but, an additional topic kind of regarding quad training is single leg movements. And, there's definitely a very obvious and easy way to bias the glute or the quad in single leg movements. So the first, I think, is super simple in that if you want the quad, you create ankle dorsiflexion. So your knee goes forward. It's very much emulating the exact same position that we were talking about in the squat or the squat machines or anything like that, where the knee gets sent super far forward over the toes. Another thing that helps that is a slightly shorter stance. So when you're doing a single leg movement, if you're a little bit shorter, it allows you to leverage over the knee a little bit more effectively. In contrast, if you're looking for more of a glute specific single leg movement, then you want to make sure that front shin is going to be vertical. So keep that knee stacked over the ankle. Don't let any ankle dorsiflexion occur. Make sure that all of your pressure is pushing through the heel and specifically the outside of the heel that aligns directly with the outside of the glute. Your stance should be a bit wider or longer rather, wider and maybe definitely longer, possibly wider. Because the point of the movement is to stretch the glute at the bottom. It is the complete antithesis of what we're trying to do when we're doing quad work, right? So at the bottom of the rep, instead of thinking about sending the knee forward and feeling the deep stretch in the quad, we want to send the torso forward and feel a deep stretch in the glute. And then when we push back up out of the bottom, the tension is coming through the heel, which is going to drive directly into the glute. So just kind of some interesting tidbits there. And then finally, final thoughts here on quad movements is a lot. Let me backtrack. When shelter in place started in March, when all this COVID stuff hit, one of the biggest problems that physique athletes were having is how do we hit the quad specifically in absence of hip extension? So this is going back to the beginning of our discussion about how every time you squat, there is hip extension and knee extension. How do we create knee extension without hip extension? In a gym, it's really easy because we have a leg extension machine. We just bend at the knee, we flex, we bend, we flex, and the quad gets worked. The reason this is necessary, like why can't we just squat all the time, right? Because squats do work all portions of the quad. The difference is that a isolation quad movement where you're creating knee extension without hip extension is going to better target the rectus femoris. A movement that extends the hip and the knee together, it spans both joints and it won't allow as much specific rectus femoris focus. So when quarantine started here, everyone was struggling to figure out ways that they could train isolation style quad movements. And we found five pretty solid variations. There's a banded leg extension. So you'll just be sitting on a bench with a band connected under the bench, and you can do leg extensions this way. Bands have their drawbacks. So that isn't my favorite movement, mostly that there's no tension at the bottom of the movement, or that it decreases tension significantly at the bottom of the movement. There's an inverted leg extension. This is actually a pretty cool movement, where you're almost in a plank position with your feet elevated on a riser, like a bench. And you're creating a leg extension movement like that. You can totally Google that to get an image there. And then you can add bands to that and make it harder. A dumbbell leg extension, not my favorite movement. I think it's really awkward to get into the dumbbell and secure it on your feet. And I feel like you spend as much time bracing and trying to hold that dumbbell in steady position as you are trying to actually move your legs. And I think that it just creates a pretty shitty stimulus to fatigue ratio. The body weight leg extension, or the reverse Nordic, was my jam at the beginning of quarantine here. If you haven't seen this movement, you essentially start kneeling on the ground with your torso completely straight up and down, and you lean back with the objective of trying to stretch the quad and get your butt to touch your heels. The caveat there is that your torso has to remain in a completely straight line with your hip, or with your legs, creating a completely straight and open hip angle. These are significantly harder than you think, so they can be assisted with bands and with a pole, or with using your hand. You can use your hand to kind of hold a wall or something like that and kind of provide assistance there. The band assistance is probably my favorite, so you can Google all these things too. And then finally, the sissy squat variations are really legit. So these kind of create the exact same idea, but you're starting standing, you get onto your toes, and then you try to drive your knees toward the ground. It has the same context as the body weight leg extensions, where you need to remain in a completely open angle. So I don't want to spend too much time there, but you know, these are some at home variations and ways that you can prioritize your quad in absence of hip extension. And if total quad hypertrophy is your goal, at least in the long term, then including these movements is going to be important. If you're just at home for 3 weeks and you're waiting for your gym to open back up, I don't think it's a huge deal if you just squatted and did different kind of squat variation movements. But anyway, just kind of some food for thought in case you are kind of working at home and don't have a leg extension machine. So anyway, kick it back to you, bro. Well,
yeah, a couple things I wanted to add. First one was a question for people who might not have their anatomy completely down pat. The rectus femoris, can you give us kind of a low-level explanation of which muscle that is in the quad?
Yeah, so that's going to be the big one that runs from the knee up and toward the hip. Yeah,
on the outside, in the middle, on the inside.
I believe it's the middle.
I thought that's what I thought too. Like the main one, like right on the top.
Yeah, the main one that runs through the middle, and so you'll just get a little bit more of a stimulus by being able to create knee extension in absence of hip extension there.
I agree. One thing I wanted to add that you were talking about right before we got into the single leg movements, especially with the kind of the knees going over the toes, there's like an age old, you know, wives' tale about it being bad for your knees and you're going to create problems, you know, going full range of motion. And I just wanted to provide a little personal insight there. So back in like 2016, I ruptured my patella tendon and had to have that surgically repaired, and was a big concern about like that. Am I going to be able to, like, what's the quality of it's going to be, you know, cause it bothered me for so long before that. It feels brand new, you know, and I'm not super young anymore. I'll be turning 33 in a couple weeks, and my left knee is as good as it ever was. And I think a big proponent of that reason why is because I kind of moved away from, like, you know, squatting for power and force output and stuff, and moved into more hypertrophy. I'm always using as much range of motion as I can, keeping my foot flat on the ground, and then using kind of different tools like elevating my heels or something like that to help me get in that full range of motion, and always, you know, moving my, trying to get my hamstring to touch my calf on, and any kind of movement where the machine or whatever equipment I'm using will allow me that depth. And it feels great. I mean, it feels better than they had in, you know, the years leading up to when I did have that injury. So I think it's, again, it's all really relative to how you recover and the kind of loads and the quality of the loads and tension you put on your joints and muscles. So it's not like, it's just, it's been proven, you know, incorrect time over time, but it's one of those things that kind of refuses to die a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other thing you alluded to was just that, you know, when you squat in this manner, you don't need as much weight. And I think that that was a huge factor. I know it was for me, and I think it was for you, in that it kind of took ego out of squatting for me a little bit. And hip hinges and squatting are two movements that I always have had ego kind of attached to. And by completely changing the way in which we squat and understanding that squatting this way is going to require less weight to get the stimulus that we're after, it really made that whole process of kind of transitioning to that squat style friendlier, more effective, and just, you know, it isn't as much stress on your joints when the weight is lower. So instead of putting yourself in these positions to maximize loading, you're putting yourself in positions to maximize muscular stimulus, which in fact is going to take stress off the joints. So just to kind of reiterate that
point. Yeah, I think you tied that up perfectly. I agree 100%. Let's move into hamstrings next a little bit. So do you want to give us a little bit of an overview on this one?
Yeah, totally. So hamstrings really have two types of movements that will target them. You have your hip hinges. These are your good mornings, your stiff-legged deadlifts, your deadlifts, I guess, but we don't really deadlift a whole ton, stimulus fatigue ratio stuff. So stiff-legged deadlift, RDL variations. These can be done single leg, double leg, good mornings. And then you have your isolation hamstring movements. So you have your leg curls, and that's, I mean, leg curls, like there's so many different variations of leg curls. You can do them seated. You can do them lying. You can do them kneeling. So they have these cool machine where you put your knee up against a pad and then your other leg is hanging off and you can curl that way. You can do them with a cable where the ankle cuff is on your leg and you're pretty much just standing against the cable machine and flexing backwards, leaving your quad stable and only flexing from the back of the knee. So a lot of different kind of variations of leg curls that you can institute into the program. But, you know, it's really simple in that your hamstring training really should just have a dedicated hip hinge movement, something for the hip hinge, and then something isolation for the leg curl. And if you have those two styles of movements in your program, you're covering all the bases that you need for hamstring development. Kind of getting into hip hinges specifically to focus on that. It's been a couple years that I've really been focusing on hip hinges, and the amount of care that I put into my technique has increased probably every month. It's like every month or two, I get to a weight and I'm like, ooh, I'm not sure that I'm performing this how I want. And I'll have to like review video and go back and, you know, really be honest with myself and hold myself accountable to perfect movement. And then I'll lower the weight 10 or 15% and I'll refine form again. And then I'll lower it another 10 to 15% and refine form. And this isn't the way that I necessarily think that you should approach this. I think that the better way, if I would have known better, would just have been that I should have chosen a much lighter weight to begin with and held myself accountable and never increased weight until I was so happy with the movement that there was no other option but to increase weight. This is kind of how I describe progressive overload too, is that you're not forcing progression, or you shouldn't be forcing progression every week. Like, especially with a hip hinge, if I try to just go every week, I'm going to add 5 or 10 pounds. Eventually I'm just going to be pulling the movement with my back and my hamstrings aren't going to be doing anything. So I think that progressive overload needs to be thought of as a necessity, or else the weight is too easy. So if I started my RDLs at 275 and for tens, and then in 1 week, maybe 5 weeks later, I was like, oh man, this 275 by 10 is just way too easy. It's not really providing me a challenge anymore. I better go add some weight to this movement. And then I stick with that weight for a while, and then that becomes too easy. And then I add weight again. So it's a more reactive way of loading movements instead of a proactive way. And I really think with all movements, you can get in trouble with proactive progressive overload, but especially with hip hinges, you can. So that's kind of been my biggest lesson with these. And, you know, back flexion in a hip hinge, back flexion is essentially the rounding of the back. I don't do it terribly. I would say the degree of back flexion that I have when I do hip hinges is maybe 3 to 5%, and it's toward the end of the set. but I don't want any back flexion. So it's difficult for me at times because I even struggle to understand what proximity to failure is with a hip hinge. And I know this is something other people have struggled with too. So to expand on that, what I mean is that if I was deadlifting in the CrossFit days and functional fitness days, failure in a deadlift is literally the inability to lift the weight off the ground without tearing your back, or at least, you know, excessive rounding to the point where you can feel it and you're like, ooh, that was too much. Even in a stiff-legged deadlift, it's really easy to continue feeling your hamstrings, but also feel your back. And the example of this would be like, say I'm doing a set of eight. I might have perfect flat back, neutral spine for reps 1 through 5. And then rep 6, I get like a degree of back flexion. But I'm like, ooh, you know, I still feel my hamstrings really hard. So then the next rep, it's like 2 or 3 degrees of back flexion. But I still feel my hamstrings, you know, and then it's like 5 degrees of flexion. And at what point is it that the back flexion is too much and suddenly you can't do it anymore? Because the truth is I could be in 5% or 5 degrees of back flexion, and then I could do another rep and be in 7 degrees, and then another rep and be in 9 degrees, and another rep and be in 12 degrees. And my back is just continually taking more of the load. My hamstrings are still taking some of the load, but the back is taking incrementally more. And I could just keep doing that. So where exactly is failure? And that's, I think, I still haven't mastered this, but I think knowledge and awareness around this is really important for me. So I film every single set of every hip hinge that I do, especially the heavy sets. And I literally sit there and I analyze my movement and I make sure that when the bar is stopped at the ground or below my knee, that the first thing that moves is that my chest rises, that we don't see my back go like this and then my chest rise, but that we're in this position and then the chest rises, right? So anyways, those are just kind of random thoughts that I have on hip hinging, but I think they're things that everybody deals with. So anyway, I'd love your thoughts on that. And then I want to circle back and talk about, leg curls.
Yeah. So I agree. And I ran through the same issues, you know, you just covered with, you know, kind of when ego and putting more weight on the bar was kind of the thing, like hip hinging, especially in like an RDL, right? Or a stiff-legged deadlift is RDL's Romanian deadlift, for anyone who's not familiar. It's easy for that to happen. And so some things that I have done over time to make that a little bit different is when I don't do as much RDLs. Or if I am doing them, it is, I'll do like a single leg with like my rear foot supported or something like that, which makes it much, much easier to be more hamstring or glute dominant. And then if I'm doing like a standard RDL or a stiff leg deadlift, I'll use a snatch grip, which makes it harder in that regard. And you have to use that lighter weight. And I've really just spent time like finding the movement really, really well and figuring out, okay, this bar path is going to work best for me, my arm length, because all these things are going to be these little kind of nuanced changes that will make things either more appropriate or less appropriate given, you know, the context of an individual and their, you know, kind of anatomical positions. So for me, like just being able to find like, okay, if I put my feet at this angle and maybe I move my toes out a little bit, I can feel it more in like that kind of hamstring adductor area. And that's going to give me a really, really good stimulus. And just kind of playing around and searching for this position gives me really, really a good, like the best stimulus. Personally, I really like the stiff leg deadlifts because you can kind of find that position before you pull the weight off the ground. So like you can set up your tension, feel it in your hamstrings, and then go from there. And then if, you know, I know I kind of lose my set, or I hit my technical failure when I lose it trying to pull it off the ground, right? So when I'm like, I kind of, the weight is still on the ground, I find that position. And if the first thing that happens is I lose the position as I try and lift the weight, I know that I've hit technical failure. So that is kind of my thought there. One movement that I did kind of want to bring up before we get into straight hamstring curls is the GHRs, glute ham raises. So these are something that you're going to be able to find more, you know, obviously much more common in like a CrossFit or functional fitness style gym, and less so in like a traditional global gym. But I would say of all movements for hamstrings, these are probably my favorite. It's a very interesting combination where you do get a little bit of, you have like an almost like an isometric type hip hinge position, but then you get that curl as well. They're very, very challenging, but I really, really do like them. I'm curious to your thoughts there.
Yeah, I like them too. I don't have a machine, so I've been having to modify with Nordics, which are basically the same idea, but you kind of wedge your feet underneath a barbell. For anyone that doesn't know, you have a barbell on the ground. It's loaded really heavy. You wedge your feet under, and then you kind of lower your body and lift your body from the ground. Really, really hard. I actually much prefer the GHR because I feel like you can drive your knees into the pad a little bit, and it provides a little bit of bracing, which makes the movement quite a little bit less drastic, maybe. Nordics are tough. I struggle with movements that require a ton of setup. I've realized that about myself over the last like year or two, is that if movements require like 5 or 10 minutes of setup and a bunch of like plates carrying and stuff like that, I'm like, find me something else to do, because that shit is so time consuming. But no, I love the GHR. I think the cool thing about the GHR too is that it's not an isolation leg curl movement, and it's also not a pure hip extension movement. So it's kind of got a little bit of components of both, which is pretty unique. Yeah. And you'll get really, really sore from doing like 2 sets of 5.
Oh yeah. You can't do much volume. It's just that challenging of a movement.
So real quick on leg curls, there was a recent study that just came out. I think it was October, 2020. It looks like Sumiyaki and colleagues, and they compared a seated leg curl to a lying leg curl, and found that the seated leg curl was more effective because it allows a stretch at the top. And this fits in line with a lot of other science that talks about, even aside from the contracted position, there is benefit to hypertrophy in the stretched position. So this is super cool, right? Like, you can think about this in relation to a dumbbell fly too, is like, if you do your dumbbell fly and you stop that thing shy of stretch, then you're actually missing out on potential hypertrophy stimulus. So I believe that this was why they found, or that they believe that this is why the seated leg curl was more effective than the lying leg curl. And then the last thing to touch on regarding leg curls is that you can really butcher this movement by trying to explode up to begin the contraction. If you explode too hard, it engages the calf. So the gastrocnemius, which is the big calf muscle, it is active for about the first 30% of the range of motion of a leg curl. It might be less in the seated leg curl, but I know it's about 30% of the movement for lying leg curl. And so if you dynamically explode up out of the bottom of that leg curl, your calf will contribute to the movement. So you want to be a little bit more controlled. And I've found it really helps if you flex your foot down. So foot down like this, instead of basically pointing your toes to your shin, so that you're creating a lengthened calf position before you leg curl. And then that can help take the propensity to use the calf out of the movement equation.
So just to make sure I understand it. So you're saying if you were to like point your toes down, like towards the floor, you can help your hamstring a little bit with your calf. But then if you would to say pull your toes back towards your shin, that will remove the calf from the movement.
Yeah, exactly. So if you put the calf into a pre-stretched position and you don't let it flex, then it will isolate the hamstring more. Whereas if you put the calf into a flexed position, or if you allow yourself to move from stretch position to flex position mid rep, then you're going to engage the calf.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm just kind of in my head thinking, I just happen to, by nature, always have my toes kind of pulled back towards my shins whenever I'm doing hamstring curls seated or lying. So it's interesting.
I think it's pretty intuitive if you've done it for a while.
And I wanted to add that if you have access to like a traditional gym, right, most people are going to use I feel like it's more historically people would use the lying hamstring curl as opposed to the seated. I had always had a preference towards the seated, and I think I just kind of maybe got lucky there, but I could just feel it so much better through like such a more full range of motion. And then something I saw, I think you posted this maybe on Instagram a week or two ago about if you lean forward, it will even increase like the full contraction, the amount of like full contraction you can get. And it makes the movement like harder, but in a good way. And I agree. Like I just always had kind of had that propensity to lean forward in them. And it's so much better than if I was to like sit all the way back into the chair and keep my, you know, torso as upright as possible. The seated leg curls, especially if you kind of slow down the eccentric, you know, and kind of don't just let it slam back up to the extension. It is an incredible, by incredible, I mean it like in the most negative term, an incredible stimulus in your hamstrings. It feels awful when you get off.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. I mean, it's terrible. I find myself grunting in the basement so much that sometimes Kim's coming down and she's like, "Are you okay? Like, what's going on?" But yeah, so leaning forward, it pre-stretches the hamstring. So it's like the old sit and reach test that you would do in school where you would sit and reach your toes, right? You're leaning forward and it's pre-stretching the hamstring. So what you're allowing by leaning forward, you're allowing your hamstring to achieve a deeper, and more tension producing stretch at the end range of the movement.
I agree. Let's quickly talk about calves. I know since it's a smaller muscle group, there isn't like as much detail or nuance to go into, but I think it's important to cover because we both have strong feelings about certain parts of it.
Yeah, for sure. So I think the biggest thing that I've learned and that kind of has come out in the industry in the last couple of years has just been the importance of the stretch position in a calf raise. And it makes sense intuitively. So when you think about it, we walk all day on our calves, like all day long, we're flexing our calves. We're walking on our toes, blah, blah, blah. They're extending, they're flexing, et cetera. The one thing that we never do in our life is actually take the calf into a contracted position from a deep stretch position. So the way that I have begun doing calf raises and prescribing calf raises is with a 2 to 3 second stretch position pause. And this isn't just a comfortable stretch. This is like literally stretch your calf as low as you possibly can at the bottom of every rep loaded. So you can think about this by like standing on the edge of a stair with one leg and your other leg is not providing any assistance. Just take that calf with your toes on the edge of the stair, take it all the way down to as deep of a stretch as you can handle and hold it there for 2 to 3 seconds and then explode up into a contraction and hold that contraction at the top for 1 to 2 seconds. And then every single rep is about a 6 second rep because you have about 3 seconds at the bottom exploding up and then a 2 second pause at the top. If you can do that and hold a dumbbell in your hand, in the hand of the working leg, then use the other hand kind of for support on like a railway or a wall or something like that. That is just absolutely wretched. And you don't need to do a ton of reps because the reps are so long, a 6 second rep, right? You do 8 reps, you're already under tension for 48 seconds. So I like the, you know, 8 to 10 rep range with those. And, man, you don't need a lot of weight at all. I've found with really focusing on it, I can do a set of 10 with each leg and literally have my calves cramping up. I can also do it with weight, but much less weight than if I'm just kind of going through reps fast and, you know, not even fast, but like, you know, a controlled tempo without pausing at the top or the bottom. You know, I can do a 70, 80 pound dumbbell for those with the pause at the top and the bottom. 6 to 8 quality reps with a 50 pound dumbbell in my hand is more than enough. So, yeah, that's my jam when it comes to calves. What about you?
I agree. One thing I wanted to ask you about quick is like, what do you think about the, like training your calves from a seated position? Like there's that, you know, like that traditional seated calf raise, machine versus like a different thing. Like you said, standing off the top of a stair or somewhere where your legs are completely straight or where your knee is not bent, I guess I should say.
Yeah, I mean, you need both. So the standing one is going to train almost exclusively the gastrocnemius, gastroc, which is the big muscle that runs up the calf. And you will get a little bit of soleus when you do that, which is the lower calf muscle. But when you bend the knee like a seated calf raise, you get the almost exclusively soleus with a little bit of gastroc. So I think very much like the quad conversation with the importance of having isolated knee extension movements. it's similar in the calf in that you can probably get some decent calf development just doing standing calf raise variations. But if you really want, you know, the last 2-3-4% development in your calves and get it all out there, you got to do a seated variation too.
Interesting take. Yeah, I personally really do not like anything where my knee is bent with the calf training. It just like it puts me in a weird, it feels like a confined position where I'm not moving freely, right? And I think one of those things, like calves are one of those things, like a lot of people don't even train them to begin with. And I think you just kind of have to kind of draw your line in the sand and see, okay, do I really want that extra 3%? Like if you're not competing or something like that, you know, my take is if I don't like it, if it puts me in a weird position where I don't feel like completely safe, or it feels like a really natural type of thing, I'm not going to do it. But you know, with everyone, that's going to, you're the only one who's going to be able to make that decision for yourself. But I really like your,
try the seated one single leg. Cause I think it does kind of put you in an awkward position when you have both legs like crammed in there and that pad is on top of your legs. But if you can kind of turn your body to a more comfortable position and do them single leg, you might find that works a little
better. That's an interesting perspective. Never tried that. That wraps up this week's episode on improving exercise execution for the quads, the hamstrings, and the calves. Come back next week where we are going to talk about all things upper body. Thank you so much for listening to Eat, Train, Prosper. If you found this episode valuable, please subscribe or share us with your friends. You can find more from Aaron at StrakerNutritionCo.com and more from Brian at EvolvedTrainingSystems.com. Talk to you guys next time.